Hey, everybody, welcome to the Daniel Davis Deep Dive Intelligence Brief, the best of what we learned this week and the most important things we discovered overnight. And we are going to launch right into that as well, because everything seems to be focusing down onto two real big issues about the Iran war. As I see it, there are really two, there are three kind of general theoretical possibilities, but in all practicality, there are two things that we could do. It's either going to be bombs away, or it's going to be walk away. Really, it's kind of come down to those two things. And there's a lot of discussion going on in Washington, D.C. right now, and in Tel Aviv, and in conversations between the two that could have war starting again as early as Monday, according to reports, which we'll get to in a minute. But first of all, let's take a look at what President Trump said to Bret Baier coming out of the Beijing meeting and heading into back into this decision-making crucible here, where he's going to have to make a decision. And he's trying to explain to Bret Baier that, don't worry about this. This whole Strait of Hormuz thing, I got that covered, and they are definitely going to give me what I want.
They're afraid to make a deal. They don't know how to make a deal. They've never been put in this position before.
So you're going to hold out until they do?
Well, I'm going to do what's right. I have to do what's right.
But the Strait should be open, right?
It should be open. Look, see, to stop the Strait is very easy. All they have to do is say, we dropped a mine in the Strait someplace. You know, so you're at a little disadvantage, but that's okay. The Strait will be open. They will not have a nuclear weapon, and the world will go on, and you will see gasoline prices drop, energy prices generally drop like nobody. Don't forget, they have a lot of boats that are loaded up with oil that are going to bring the oil out as soon as this is over, and I think it's going to end fast. They've been holding up the world for many, many years with the Strait. You know, they've used this many, many times. They said, we'll close the Strait. They've closed it in the past. They use it as a weapon. They're not using it as a weapon with me. And what they did, and actually what President Xi said last night, sort of smiling about it, he said, well, they close the Strait, and then you close them.
But you think they're going to capitulate sometime soon?
Yeah, oh, sure.
Okay. Sure. They're going to capitulate. What does that even mean? There's a number of things in there that I want to talk about, because we need to be very clear on something. He said one of the few things he did say is that there's not going to be negotiations, and I think that is a true statement, though maybe not for the reasons he thinks. But let's just take a look at that. He says, yep, the Strait will definitely be open. How? How are you going to get the Strait open? He started talking about one thing there, about a mine. He said that's how easy it is to close. And okay, that's one of many ways that the Iranians can keep it shut down. How do you get rid of that? That's what was completely absent from that. And look, props to Bret Baier, because he asked some of the hard questions, and some of the things he actually pushed back on, didn't ask too many easy questions, or at least he illuminated, put in the room the opportunity for us to get the real answers here, or to see where Trump actually is. I wished he had pushed a little bit harder. Because the first, what should have been obvious follow-up question to that statement was, okay, Mr. President, but how? You say, yes, they're going to capitulate. How will you get them to capitulate? When everything that we have tried through the first 40-some-odd days of the war, when it was a hot phase, and nearly 14,000 targets were struck inside of Iran, and they still have 30 of 33 missile batteries or missile factory missile launch capabilities on the Gulf, along the Gulf, through the both the Persian Gulf and the Gulf of Oman and through the Strait. 30 of 33 are still active. And of course, that doesn't even talk about the dozens that are further back in the country that's the size of much of Western Europe. How do you plan on doing that? He had no answer, because there is no answer. You tried militarily to compel them to force it open. And of course, we actually have to back up a little bit there. You started using force, and that's what caused the Strait to close. See, he's trying to make this case in there. Oh, they've closed it before. I assume he's talking about back in the days of the tanker wars in the Reagan administration, where there was some limitations on some of that. And that's when we had that, I think it was more than a year of escorting tankers through there. I guess that's what he's talking about here. But there's no other time where they close it. And even then, they didn't close the thing down. This is the only time it's been done, and only because we launched into this war. So once it got closed, now then you're thinking, oh, snap. Because by all accounts, many people, and I've talked to some folks here even just in the last 24 hours, that say that President Trump was convinced by Netanyahu, by members of the IDF, that the war would be won in about 4 days, that the assassination of Ali Khamenei, the supreme leader, all the other people they would kill, all the things they would blow up, the damage they would do to the country, that would cause them to capitulate within about 4 days. And that's one of the reasons why President Trump in the first few days said, we've won. Yep, we've won, because things were happening that made it appear that they were going to be right, because that target set that he had authorized was being hit, was being destroyed. And he did. He saw all that kind of stuff falling through there. So he's thinking, we've won. That's when he said, you know, unconditional surrender. That's the only thing I'm accepting. Remember those days? In the first few days, he said those things. Kind of went silent on those as it became clear in the after the week. And then it started spinning on into more days than that. And it became evident that not only were they not going to capitulate, were they not going to collapse, now then their stranglehold on that Gulf, on the Straits rather, is ironclad. And now he can't force it open. Then he spent the rest of that time trying to force them to get it open. He didn't. And burned through huge portions of our offensive and defensive missiles in the effort to try and get that done. So if you've tried that and it hasn't worked, then Brett Baer asked him, what is it going to be new now? Because he's like, oh, yeah, sure, we're going to get that done. And then he tries to give you some other things in there. He says, listen, again, this whole thing, well, you know, they can't have a nuclear weapon, okay? And how is your actions right now going to ensure they don't? Because you claimed, of course, Operation Midnight Hammer in 2025, obliterated and all that kind of stuff. And now then, we have attacked all this kind of stuff. So what has changed that's going to say they can't have a nuclear weapon? What are you going to do to ensure that they can't? Because as Ted Postol said on our show, and we'll show you a bit of that here in a little bit, it's the intellectual capacity of the Iranian side that's the real potential for that. You have to negotiate that away or destroy everybody. It's not just the facilities. It's not just the nuclear dust, as he calls it. That's not what it is. It's about the intellectual capacity, and you can't destroy that. So what are you going to do to make sure there is no nuclear weapon capacity? He had no answer for that. And then he tries to calm everybody down that all of the prices that are going through the roof here. I mean, gasoline is through the roof. I mean, that's hitting every single American. It's hitting so many with people already rationing in Asia, in Africa. And now then they're on the verge of doing so in some places in Europe. I mean, that's all over the place. I mean, rationing potentially, but the prices are up everywhere, especially for diesel, which obviously makes the cost of all commerce go up, because everything, long-range trucking, shipping, everything, you name it, is done on that. Jet fuel, of course, comes out of a lot of the derivatives that we could get out of the Persian Gulf. That's not going in. And he says, yeah, but don't worry about it, because I'm going to get the Strait open pretty soon. All those tankers in there, all that oil will just start flowing. Okay, let's be crystal clear on this, and everybody needs to understand this. If we have some magic deal that gets this thing open and we don't go back into war, it is going to be months, many months, before we get even close to back to what the flow was of oil and gas and other derivatives coming out of the Gulf prior to the war. And whatever those ships are, there certainly are quite a number of them that are sitting there waiting to get out, and they can immediately head out. But it's a trickle, because you've got to remember, we've got shut-in problems both in Iran and in all the GCC countries, or it's many of them, to where they've had to suppress, shut down, or drastically slow down some of the wells. And when no one knows what it's going to be like to restart them. Maybe everything works great, but maybe it doesn't. Maybe there's some real problems. So it's going to take time to get that back up. And then, of course, the bigger issue is all these VLCC tankers that are going to have to come from everywhere else. You see what I'm saying? There is a long, unwinding problem. So President Trump is just categorically wrong when he claims, oh yeah, prices of oil, price of gasoline, everything's going to be coming way down once I get this done, because it's not. It isn't. It's high, and it's going to stay high for a while, and we just have to hope that we don't make it worse. Then he moves on here. Now we're going to get into some of the issues in that same interview about the one of the three possibilities, what I just said. There's generally three possibilities. You can have a negotiated settlement, you can walk away, or it could be bombs away, right? Those are the three categorical ones. Well, I think it's really just two. It's really just walk away or bombs away, because we have really destroyed the field for diplomacy, as Trump inadvertently discusses here.
It seems like they're playing with a bad deck, to your point.
They have no deck.
But they're still playing.
No, the only thing they have going is a fake press. They know how well we're doing militarily. And then at the request of a very nice group of people from Pakistan who are very close to Iran. I didn't go that final. They said, could you stop? We're going to make a deal. And we really had the confines of a deal. No nuclear. They were going to give us the dust, nuclear dust, all the everything we wanted. And every time they make a deal, the next day it's like we didn't have that conversation. And that's taken place about five times. There's something wrong with them. Actually, they're crazy.
Now, how are you going to have negotiations with a country, if you're Iran, with another country, when the leader of that country says stuff like that? You're crazy. When you have the Secretary of State saying crazy in the brain, or whatever that phrase was he said last week. And then you have him saying this stuff. I thought we had a deal. Five times I thought we had a deal. If that sounds familiar to you, it should, because earlier in his administration, in this term here, last year, he said five times I had a deal with President Putin to end that war. And then he keeps changing the deal. Literally the same thing. And the Russian side said there's never been a deal unless you're willing to accommodate our objectives and our requirements in the diplomatic front. Then yeah, we can have one, but no one has ever agreed to anything. And that's definitely the case here. So you have the Iranian side hearing all that, and they're thinking, what the hell? This guy's not even operating on a coherent level. So how could, aside from all of the broken trust and the broken promises of the past, like with the unilateral withdrawal from the JCPOA in 2018, the assassination of their general in 2020, the pretending that we were negotiating in 2025, the pretending that we were negotiating here, and in both cases launched a war. And then now you're saying you want it again because you're having a need for it because you realize you couldn't compel them to give up. What, I mean, just from that, why would they talk to you at all? The answer is they wouldn't unless you surrender to their terms. But then you add on top of it that, and you see that there is no practical path diplomatically. Trump can't agree to anything. He doesn't appear to be able to. And even if he did, why would Iran believe any of it? Why would they act on any of it? Now, for Iran's point, Foreign Minister Abbas Araghchi this week addressed one more time this whole issue that Trump mentioned in that first clip I showed you about, oh, they can't have a nuclear weapon. That's causing a lot of frustration itself on the Iranian side, as Mr. Abbas says here.
Iran has never wanted nuclear weapon. And we have proved that when we signed the deal in 2015. And we have said times and again that we don't want nuclear weapon. And this is not our policy.
And of course, people may look at that and they think, well, of course, he's going to say that. Well, forget about it. Don't ever take anything at face value. I never do. I never take anything at face value, whether it's Abbas Araghchi, whether it's the Mujtaba Khamenei, whether it's Donald Trump, whether it's you name it, anybody. I take nobody at face value. I listen to everything, but then we always narrow it down to what can be shown on the ground. What does the physical evidence show? And the physical evidence seems to imply that that is correct, that they had a deal where they willingly negotiated away all kinds of benefits on their side and took very coercive terms in order to get something, sanctions relief, that they had. They didn't want one. Our intelligence validated that they didn't have a nuclear weapons program. We don't take his word for it. We took Tulsi Gabbard's word for it. We took all the Western intelligence assessments from 2003 all the way up through today. They don't have a nuclear weapons program. They have made no plans to have one. The only thing that we have said is that they had the breakout capacity has been expanding. You know, the 60% reprocessing, all that kind of stuff means they could, if they made a decision, go to a bomb. They have never had one. And when they did go up to first 20% and then 60%, they always did so in response to something that we had done, some sanction we put down, and with the caveat that they wanted to go back to the terms of the JCPOA, in which case they would reduce their capability as long as we were good on our end. That's what they have said. So you saw the frustration on his face there. We keep talking about this. You keep saying that's the main thing, and that's never existed. So They weren't 2 weeks from a nuclear bomb when we started this. That was complete fabrication and a lie on our part, categorical. They aren't 2 weeks from a bomb now, which Secretary of Energy Wright said a couple of days ago, also categorically false and a lie. I don't know why they're continuing saying that when it's been proven not to be the case. And even according to President Trump, if you want a source, go with that one, where he said, you know, everything was obliterated. We have satellites watching it day and night. They haven't touched it. If they do, we'll start bombing, et cetera. So it's physically impossible, according to what President Trump has said. If you want to believe or disbelieve someone, I guess choose him. We do know that they did strike those targets. So we have some physical evidence that that part is right, that it has been severely damaged. Whether it was taken out beforehand is subject to the speculation, and we just don't know. Maybe it was, maybe it wasn't, but those sites were definitely hit. So there is evidence that there has never been a nuclear weapon program or bomb. So if that's your causes belli for the war, and that's what you're saying you want to negotiate with now, and the other side's saying, dude, I don't have it, and I never had it, so where is the basis to have a negotiation? What do you want me to give away? If you want me to say it, I'll say it again, and he did. How many times have we shown you over the past months, really, even before this war, where we keep saying all they have to do is say they don't want a nuclear weapon, but they won't do it? And they keep saying it over and over, exactly what you say they aren't doing on camera. So you see where why I'm saying that there's no path for negotiation. So it's either bombs away or walk away. And there are definitely advocates for the bombs away. Let's get to one here right now. That is General Keith Kellogg.
It was very clear to me the respect they have for President Donald J. Trump. It was clear if you compare previous visits from like President Obama to President Trump, there's no doubt. And I think they understand that we've got, you know, our foot on the throat of Iran, and they need Iran. When you look at 90% of the Iran exports go to China to feed their economy, their economy is not doing well. Ours is. We don't need the Gulf oil. They do. And they need oil to expand their economy. So when I look at what's happening in the Gulf, it's really good. The only reasonable guy in this whole thing has been President Trump. He's been a war president. Look, I'm just noise level. He's the president of the United States. Constitutionally, he's the commander-in-chief. He's the only commander-in-chief. But I'm one of those guys who goes a little bit harder on it, meaning I would like to take something of value and put them, their administration, the Iranians, at risk. And that's the reason I've said repeatedly, take something like Karg Island or seize the islands in the Strait. The reason for that is like taking your car or your house. Now I own it. You've got my phone number. Give me a call. We don't want it back. And then we'll talk about it.
So a couple of things from there. First of all, when he makes this cocky statement, well, a couple of things. One thing he actually said has some validity. You see, we've got our foot on their neck. And we're hurting them. Our blockade is hurting Iran. And that's a fact. I saw some reports this morning that there is huge unemployment. People are losing their jobs. Inflation is going through the roof. It's costing lots of money to get anything. There's the absence of a lot of products because things aren't able to get in. They have land routes and they're doing some business there, but it's a significant degradation over what it was before. So they really are hurting, and the sanctions and the efforts to destroy their currency, all those things are having genuine effect on Iran. They are suffering. There's no doubt about it. But what we keep saying is they expected that. They have history with it. They know how to mitigate it, and they know how to suffer. So if anybody's thinking, well, yeah, because it's bad now, and they're going to rise up and defeat their government for us, you're going to be waiting a long time before that happens here. But then there's some things he says that are categorically untrue. For example, he says, we don't need their oil. That's one of the things. We don't need Middle Eastern oil. We got all our own oil. So it needs everybody else. If we don't need their oil, why has oil spiked up to $5 a gallon in America? I mean, really, if we don't get oil from the Strait of Hormuz, if that doesn't come to us, our gas prices shouldn't have even changed, right? Why have they? Because oil is a global commodity. Because if you have the price go up in one place, it's because it goes all over the place. Everybody pays more, even when we have it here. And one of the other things that's causing that price spike is because we are very foolishly giving away our oil. And when I say give away, I mean sell it through our strategic petroleum reserve. So we've increased the exports for a period of time, because you can't just turn on the pumps and say, yeah, let's get more out of the ground and just start exporting that too. You can't do that. And by the way, we are still a net importer. I forget the number, three to six million barrels per oil a day. We still have to bring in from other sources because we are a net importer. But we're exporting certain categories of things and things that we can produce because the world is desperate and hungry for it, because that at least mitigates some of the loss that's coming out of the Persian Gulf. So he's just wrong when he says that. And then we're foolish for trying to keep the price artificially down by getting rid of our emergency backup. That the reason you have that is so if there's an unexpected supply disruption, that you can, for your own country, take care of your needs. Now then, we're getting rid of that. Now the companies that are doing all this stuff and that have done the storage, they're making money hand over fist, so they're fine with it. All the rest of our country is paying for this actions, though, every time you go to the pump, and now every time you go to the grocery store, because the diesel has gone up. It's going to cost more for farming. It's going to cost more to get the trucks to get things around. It's going to cost more for ships to bring things out. Everything is going up, and we pay for that. He's oblivious to that, or he's lying. I don't know which, but he's wrong. I can tell you that. Now, it's one thing for a retired General Keith Kellogg to be saying stuff like that. We know Trump listens to him. We know he does. He used to be one of his envoys for Ukraine. He's a former national security advisor for the vice president in the first Trump administration. So he obviously listens to him. I don't know why. He has been proven wrong catastrophically so many times, but he still does. But it's one thing if it's a retired guy. It's another thing if it's an active duty flag officer. And one of the reasons why President Trump may make these kind of claims that he does on a regular basis about, oh, we've destroyed them, we've defeated them militarily, we've already won militarily, because he may be listening to guys like Admiral Cooper.
The defense industrial base for their drones and their missiles and their Navy were degraded by 90%. They have about 10% left. For the Navy, my military assessment would be that the Navy will not begin to rebuild for 5 to 10 years. Okay. The days of $35,000 drones that we saw in the last couple of years, particularly in the fight against the Houthis in Yemen, those days are behind us. Today, we face an increased threat from drones that are highly sophisticated. They're jet-powered. They have high-end sensors. They have electronic warfare. They have signals intelligence. So those days of using high-value defenses to shoot down cheap targets are behind us. Quite the contrary, what we have been doing lately is using our own low-cost one-way attack drones, attacking Iran, making them use higher and more expensive weapons. So I can confidently tell you, we have flipped the cost curve in many ways.
Flipped the cost curve, 90% gone. That's nonsense. That's self-evidently untrue. You can also take that the New York Times, Washington Post, Wall Street Journal, CNN have all independently reported various reports that they've done that Iran has somewhere around 75% of all the things that they had. Some reports suggest it could be as high as 90% of their missile capacity. They still have it. Obviously, they have it. Just imagine the irrational. We would be among the historically the most foolish country ever if you had degraded somebody militarily and you had your foot on their neck, like Kellogg said, and you'd taken 90% of their capability away, and then you pulled your boot off. And then you had a ceasefire. So, all right, fella, how about y'all recover? We're going to give you a month or so to get everything back in case and get some of the rubble off of some of these mountainsides that we damaged, but we haven't destroyed, so that you can again start using them again. Sure, y'all take your time. Don't worry. Let me know when you're ready. You see what I'm saying? You know how stupid that would be? And we're not stupid. We lie a lot, but we're not stupid. If we had taken them down 90% and they literally had 10% left, just this tiny little fraction, we would have amped up our attacks. We would have hit them even harder. And then we would have had that unconditional surrender. We would have had that USS Missouri moment, and the whoever was left over in Tehran would come, you know, quaking in their boots with a little pen and saying, where do I sign my surrender instrument? That's what the problem is. That's one of the big problems that we have, is that we have guys like Kellogg who probably do know the truth and are just lying. And then we have guys in uniform, like Admiral Cooper, who are telling things that are illogical and irrational and can't be true. And we see that they're not. And there he is, under oath, in front of God and the country, just saying things that on the face can't be true. If it was, then this strait would be open. We would have already won. But if President Trump is listening to this guy, and we know for sure that there are two camps on the inside of Trump, one that's advocating the walk away theory, one that's advocating the bombs away theory. And if President Trump hears the commander of Central Command say that, now, whether he's saying that in public and saying something different in private, that I don't know. I don't have any insight into that. Maybe he is telling him something true on the inside. I don't know. But surely these guys, the other guys in the bombs away theory, they're not telling him those kind of things. They're saying, God, he's just wobbling, man. He's right on the edge. We can go and we'll finish the job once and for all. That's who President Trump is listening to. And look, and I mentioned some stuff about the New York Times. The bombs away crew seems to be gaining the upper hand right now. This is from the New York Times here. Two Middle Eastern officials who spoke on condition of anonymity to discuss operational matters said the United States and Israel are engaged in intense preparations, not just discussions. The largest since the ceasefire took effect for the possible resumption of attacks against Iran as early as next week. There was separate reporting this morning that talked about how that the U.S. and Israel are working, cooperating and discussing actively today. And they say in the next 24 hours, they will probably come up and make a decision about what to do. And potentially as early as Monday, if they go down the bombs away path, then we could be seeing something on the ground then. There you see one of the New York Times articles. Iran, on the other hand, is saying, listen, simultaneously with this, I think I showed you earlier this week from our UN ambassador, Mike Waltz, is trying to get this UN Security Council resolution to condemn Iran for closing the Strait of Hormuz. How dare they close the Strait of Hormuz over a, quote, dispute over a nuclear program? I kind of forgot to mention the war that we started, but whatever. It hasn't succeeded so far, but the Iranian mission to the United Nations put this out yesterday. Yesterday it says, it is now crystal clear that the U.S. is seeking to exploit the number of the so-called co-sponsors of its politically motivated and one-sided draft resolution to manufacture a false image of the broad international support for its ongoing unlawful actions to pave the way for future further military adventurism in the region. Should the U.S. trigger any escalation, all the co-sponsoring states will share international responsibility alongside with Washington for the consequences. No political excuse or diplomatic cover can absolve them of responsibility for facilitating, enabling, and legitimizing U.S. aggression against them. So they're saying, listen, if the war breaks back out, we're not just going to go after the folks in the region, but anybody who signs on to this to try and condemn us, you could potentially be a target too. I don't know how they would do that. I don't know whether they would do it, but that's certainly a threat. Meanwhile, you have this senior Iranian figure, Mr. Arag, who was on the ISNA, their official news organization, says, we have given up on our sovereign right over the Strait of Hormuz and allowed military equipment to be used against us to pass through the strait that belongs to Iran. We will not do that anymore, and that's as of today. And what he's referring to there is the reports over the last week or so to where a couple of U.S. warships were allowed to transit through. We're not allowed to. They did. They transited through there. Allegedly, they came under fire. One version is that they came under sustained fire from the Iranian side, but we defeated all of their incoming drones and missiles, and we were able to get out without losing anything further. The Iranian side claims that they fired warning shots and gave a warning, said, you leave or we will destroy you, and then we left after that, and they fired some warning shots. I don't know which is true. Both sides have a reason to make it look like their side is right. But now then, what Iran is saying is, try that one more time. Any warships come into the Gulf now, we're going to take them out. Now, that is, since that spate of things happened, after that, the Iranian Navy published a picture of one of their submarines having surfaced in the Gulf and said, by the way, we have submarines and they're on duty and patrolling. There's also, of course, we know they have underwater missiles, what they call just basically modernized torpedoes. that can be launched from underwater caves. You don't even have to have a torpedo for that, or a submarine for that, but they have those as well. And these are hard to surface because they're actually pretty small, hard to find. They're relatively quiet. I think they're diesel motors. They're much more dangerous than it sounds. Sounds like old technology, but especially in some of the shallow waters, those things can be effective. So they're saying, yeah, that's not going to happen anymore. So the question is, where are we going to go from here? And that is the problem, because the things continue to pile up, that we're not going to do diplomacy, that we're not going to do the walk away. We're going to do the bombs away. And I pray and hope something comes up, because it will just be catastrophic for our interest if that's the case. And Alistair Crook, in fact, we had on this week, who laid the foundation for why the diplomatic is not really one of the valid options, is because we have poisoned the water so much that no one believes us.
There's no trust with the United States government. I mean, they've three times, in fact, decided to do sneak attacks in the middle of negotiations. So there isn't any great sort of sense of confidence that, you know, they can come to an agreement. So the Iranians will insist, okay, but we want this in a formal legal treaty through the Security Council or through Congress. Trump can't do that.
So the most important issue right now is the question of trust. We cannot trust Americans at all. So everything should be exact. Everything should be defined very clearly before we can conclude a deal. And it is obvious that those things they have not been able to achieve militarily, they cannot achieve on negotiation table.
To my big regret, there are no diplomats on European side that are ready to engage, that are ready to do our professional job, what we were trained for, to get together, to find solutions, to propose solutions to our capital. The ones that I face are mere propagandists, and diplomats should listen to each other and should try to inform their capitals in an unbiased way to take very necessary decisions. So far, this is not the case, and this is a source of big frustration for me. But I think I will continue still my job here, and I will try to wake up at least some of my colleagues before it is too late.
And look, that was kind of a montage of a bunch of things that came from this past week. Important things you need to know, but it just highlights painfully that it's not just one thing here. We keep not wanting to be, we don't want to keep our word in anything. We want to cajole, we want to threaten, we want to bomb. And then when we don't get our way, we'll just say whatever we need to try and get it. And if we say something and the other side doesn't do what we want, then we'll just renege on it and just go away, or we'll just get out of the deal. Of course, this goes back a long way. Bush got out of a lot of these long-range nuclear non-proliferation treaties. Trump did the same thing. Biden did a lot of things that were against, that went back on some of our agreements. He certainly did that with the Taliban. Just forget about what the previous administration had done, et cetera. And then went on his own schedule. We have a habit of this at a country level. It's not a red or a blue thing. It's an American thing that we have become really comfortable at lying. And here is the payoff, or the payback, rather. This is the bitter cost for that. Now, it's one thing if you're big enough and strong enough, you can do whatever you want. We didn't care about keeping our word to the Taliban. If we wanted to, instead of May 31st, I think, which is the date for we were supposed to have been out, Biden didn't even give it a second thought. He goes, yeah, well, we'll do it on September 11th. We're not ready, so we're not going to do it. We didn't negotiate anything. We're not going to keep our word on that, and we're going to do it here because it's good for me. So we didn't even worry about that. And then, of course, all the things that we have with the Russian side, you can go back to 2014. You can go back to the Minsk agreements, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And then all the stuff with these stuff we've talked about with Iran. We have destroyed our credibility. So now when we need a deal, when we need a negotiated settlement, and we need somebody to believe us, they won't. So now then that leaves either just walk away in shame, and the walk away is still the least bad of all the options, but it still requires eating crow, because you can be guaranteed your political opponents here will certainly shine a light on that and say, oh, no, this is a huge failure, and your adversaries definitely will, and will look bad. It's the least bad. But the worst alternative is to say, all right, because I have no credibility and I can't do a diplomatic outcome now, I'm going to go back to the kinetic, which will make things worse. And that's just where we are. Let's jump here to Robert Burns. He's always got a lot of great things to say this week. And none was more focused on kind of tracking about how Trump is not really worried about the things that have to do with the deals of a term, as much as they do with how much money can I make.
Now, his real original goal was to carry a Persian head with him into Z to brag. That's why he's obsessed, by the way, with the nuclear dust. It has nothing to do with the nuclear program. He wants a trophy. That's the way his mind thinks now. He wants trophies, trophies, trophies. And he wants the nuclear dust himself. Iran understands that. That's why the one thing they're not going to give it to him. It's the Persians, for crying out loud. Who came up with the idea? Let's take on the Russian bear, the Persian tiger, and the Chinese panda at the same time. The three greatest historical continuous civilizations in the history of the world. This is the insanity of the West. But everything was put on hold until after China. After China, we'll see what happens. Now, there may be some surprises coming out of China that will shock Trump's own base, because Trump is considering basically cutting a bunch of deals that are going to enrich. People should ask, why is Tim Cook going with him to China? This is a longtime adversary of Trump. Why is that going on? Why are a bunch of corporate CEOs going with him? Trump is doing what he's been doing for the last 6 months or a year, which is just shaking people down, using the presidency of the United States to enrich a bunch of donor class pals and friends and family members. Don't be surprised if he gives away the store to China. Yeah, why don't you come and own this piece of land, own this factory, own this. Just make sure my boys get a piece.
Yeah, just make sure my boys get a piece. And, that's the evidence is there for anyone to see. We've talked about a lot of these deals, and every time Trump over the last 3 or 4 weeks, or even more than that, had made some statement that caused the markets to gyrate, especially the price of oil to move either way up or way down. It seemed as though someone had some advanced knowledge of what he was going to say and when he was going to say it. And then they made some trades right before that to the tune of billions of dollars. Allegedly, it's being investigated now, but I'll believe that when I see it. But what we do know is that somebody's making hundreds of millions of dollars with this knowledge. I'm pretty sure they don't care how the thing works out as long as they get their cash. We're going to continue to monitor that as well. One of the other things that we had on this week was very illuminating, is that we had MIT professor Ted Postol back on the show again to look into a little bit more of this idea that Robert Burns mentioned, that Trump wants the nuclear dust. We wanted to find out, what are you talking about when he says nuclear dust, and how effective would that be if we got it to achieving the goal of a denuclearized Iran? President Trump is focused so much on this 440 some odd kilogram of 60% reprocessed material and getting that out, and we're going to get it back, et cetera. But according to that atomic bulletin of the atomic sciences, that they're saying, look, there's a lot of others. And even if more time, even if that Iran would actually give that up, that's not going to take off the table their ability to later in the future produce a bomb. Is that not accurate?
I think the knowledge is there in the population of engineers and scientists. And we're not talking about, a half dozen people. We're talking about thousands of people, thousands of extremely highly trained, accomplished professionals. So, this is not going to go away.
And I see.
The point that I will be making later in our discussion is that there is no hope of militarily solving this problem. It's simply not, unless you want to turn all of Iran into a radiating ruin with hundreds of or thousands of nuclear weapons and just kill everybody.
Yeah, there you go. You want to denuclearize the country? Kill everybody. Turn it into a nuclear wasteland by dropping hundreds of nuclear weapons, because that's what it would take. You realize that many of these underground bunkers, I think I've shown you this before, like this one here at Yaz, for example, these are specifically designed to withstand nuclear blasts. They have, I think I've also told you before, we have a facility similar to this, not too far from Washington, D.C., which is the command center in times of war, where we think that there's a possibility of a nuclear blast. It's in the side of a mountain, and I operated in there for a period of time during one of our wars while I was assigned to the Pentagon. So I've seen these things, and I know that they're designed to stand nuclear blast. So even a nuclear blast would not accomplish the objective, and they would retain the ability to have a second strike, and then they would, of course, at that point, race to a bomb. They would be insane not to, and they aren't insane, so they would. And then they would use it at that point. After you've used one on them, you can count on it. One's coming back because they have the capacity to do it, and I doubt seriously. And one of the things Ted said in that program there, which you can certainly go back to our main channel and take a look at that, and I do recommend you watch anybody who has an interest in what that was. One of the things he explained is that even without this 400 something kilograms of 60% enriched uranium, they still have a lot of other materials, nuclear materials that they could reprocess, and they have the capacity to build new facilities to make even more. Even if they got rid of all that, they could get more. And then with these facilities, they could spin them into new capabilities, and they could have one or two bombs a year, even with some of the least capable nuclear materials that they are, meaning that if you used a nuclear weapon on them, even if it was later, one is going to come back because they have the intellectual and scientific knowledge of how to do that. So the best thing you can do to help them get that is to go to war with them and bomb them. And that's what it seems that we've done, which is why I still go back to the walkaway theory is still the best chance that we have to avoid a bad outcome. And all the other bomb away is just going to lead us into potential catastrophic results. We'll see what it's going to be. Last thing I want to talk about today is I want to talk a little bit about the Russia-Ukraine war. And unfortunately, there have been some changes of late that is bringing that back into to the fore. Really, for the first of this year and all during the time of the Iran war that we've been fighting, the Russians kind of been on the side stage. It hasn't been really that active, and there hasn't even been a whole lot going on the ground. There hadn't been any major cities won or lost or anything. There's been a couple of Ukrainian counterattacks. They've had some success. They were end up being pushed back. Russia is now moving further, especially in the Zaporizhia area. Here in just the last few days, they have started moving forward. But Valery Gerasimov, the chief of the Russian General Staff, made a statement today to announce that the Oblast of Luhansk is now, according to him, fully in Russian control.
Завершив освобождение Луганской Народной Республики, наступает на широком фронте на запад в Харьковской области. Ведутся бои по освобождению населенных пунктов Новый Мир, Дружелюбовка, Чернещина. Кроме того, продолжается уничтожение формирования противника в Светогорске в Донецкой Народной Республике. Штурмовые подразделения 25-й армии продолжают уличные бои по освобождению Красного Лимана, крупного административного центра и железнодорожного узла. Под нашим контролем находится 85% территории города.
Now, Krasny Liman is something that Russia had been trying to capture for a long time, and for, like I say, most of the first part of this year had hardly any movement at all, hadn't really done a lot. There have been some exchanges of fire, but no more. Now it looks like Russia's concerting its efforts to try and now completely take that city, and it's got some real hubs and whatever that help with logistics elsewhere. Lots of on the tactical level, lots of reports that Russia is massing troops in a number of different places for a large scale operational level offensive sometime either in the later part of the spring or the early part of the summer. Of course, we're getting into that period right now. So apparently that's something that could be coming very soon. We'll wait and see what they end up doing. Like I said, in the Zaporizhia area, in the southern part of the line of contact, there has been a number of advances by the Russians here just in the last 3 days. We'll see how that continues to work out. Of course, also, and I think we talked about this a couple of days ago, in a 24-hour period, there were 1,500 drones and missiles fired from Russia into Ukraine. Ukraine itself also fired back several hundred in the Russian direction, some of which had some pretty substantial strikes on energy facilities deep inside of Russia. That second one is what has a lot of the Russians upset. And there has been a growing number of public officials. So there's been on Telegram and some of the other social medias, a lot of grumbling on the Russian side of anger at Putin, not for fighting the war, not for not ending it, but for not fighting it harder, not for pushing more. And they're saying, what is wrong with the Russian leadership? Why are they not winning this war? And some of that criticism is starting to have some effect, it appears, or alternatively, according to some analysts that I've talked to, that Russia has been preparing for something much bigger for a while now. And they needed the front line to stay active, but not to go too far, because they needed time to build up more resources, more long-range drones, more missiles, more armored vehicles, train more combat troops out of contact. And apparently now those things are nearing completion. And what we've seen from publicly from a couple of pretty well-known figures on the Russian side, Karaganov was being one of them, has said they outright, and we showed this earlier this week from Glenn Deason's show, to where he outright advocated, we should fire conventional missiles at a lot of military sites and military factories throughout Western Europe, where they make the long-range missiles and the rocket motors and drones for Ukraine to use against us. It's only fair. Why should you help kill Russians and destroy stuff, and you have, you know, a free hand to do it? So the logic in the Russian side goes. And so these guys are saying, Karaganov in particular, I advised our government to do that. And if the West doesn't get the message, if that doesn't deter them from stopping, then we should go nuclear weapons. That's what he said. And he's not the only one that said that. So as I said toward the end of the week, I said, listen, it's one thing if it's somebody online, it's like Keith Kellogg or Lindsey Graham even, or some of these others, Jack Keane, saying one thing. They're former officials and they talk to the president, but they're not in the government. It's a little bit different other than Lindsey Graham, but it's different if it's like an ambassador. So I wanted to find out, what would somebody that's in an official capacity in the government, what would they say to those kind of comments? And I'll say I was not expecting what I got, but here is the core of my interview with Dmitry Polyansky. I know you're certainly not going to give any military secrets out over our channel here or commit your government to anything, but in the event that the decision makers in Moscow said, all right, that's it, that's it, they've gone too far, they crossed whatever red line is set in the Kremlin, and now that we're going to do something, would we expect to see some sort of ultimatum or something from Moscow that says, all right, if this doesn't change, we're going to do this? Or would it be, no, you're just going to wake up one day and a missile is going to land somewhere?
Well, I would just advise everybody I would advise against testing the limits of our patience and the limits of our self-restraint. The fact that NATO is now directly involved in war against Russia by providing airspace to Ukrainian drones, by placing the production of drones, of other warfare in their territory, I think it brings us very, very close to this conflict, which again will have very devastating consequences for European population. And I think that European population is not aware of this. It's being brainwashed, and they are hearing arguments like the ones that you cited, that Russia will never dare use anything against Europe. I wouldn't be so sure, because Europe has used everything against Russia right now. Europe is providing weapons to Ukraine. They provide the missiles that can be used only with the approval and under the control of specialists from the United Kingdom, Great Britain, France, whoever. So I think that they have already crossed all the red lines, and it's a matter of time if it continues like this. And then people will ask questions, so what did we do? Why did Russia respond so harshly and so resolutely? But it will be too late.
You see, even when he made that statement there, I was like, wait, are you going to say something else, like mitigate that, but say like, well, there's still time? And he didn't. He just ended it right there. It may already be too late. He said that the European populations may wonder why we kept warning about these red lines, and then why did Russia respond so harshly? And he said, this is going to be the reason why, and it may already be too late. Now, let me just address something here. To many people listening to this right now, maybe even some who are friends of our channel, they may be saying, come on, that's too far. Russia's not going to do that. They can boast. They've been saying stuff all throughout this war. And I'm talking from the very first year, from the first few months, they, you know, did some nuclear saber rattling and they threatened all this kind of stuff. And they said they would do this too, and they never did any of it. So allegedly tanks were a red line. We put tanks in there. Long range artillery, that was a red line. We put that in there. Nothing happened. F-16s, Tomahawks. No, I don't think we did Tomahawks. The ATACMs, the Storm Shadow, all kinds of stuff. Everybody said, if you put this in there, then Russia's going to retaliate. We put all of it in there. Nothing happened. Then we're using targeting from our intelligence. We're training there. And Russia never did anything because they never will do anything, because they can't do anything, because they're smart. They're not stupid. They know that if they do that, if they attack anything in Western Europe, now then it's game on. Article 5, and Russia's going to get crushed, or that they could then go nuclear and then everybody's going to lose, and they're not stupid, so they're not going to do that either. That's the general consensus of nearly everybody that I've talked to. And in our lifetimes, I don't think there's very few people that are still alive, if anyone, from the last time a nuclear weapon was used in August 1945 in Japan. So for that generation, they were sharply focused on even the possibility of a nuclear weapon. And there was great fear, healthy fear of that. And so people didn't want to go too far down the line to do that. We had, of course, the Cuban Missile Crisis because of the realization of what had just happened just a handful of years before that in Nagasaki and Hiroshima. That was one of the reasons why Khrushchev and Kennedy pulled down the escalation ladder, because they realized the consequences because both of them had fought in the war. So they knew that. That's one of the reasons they were able to make that situation, and we got off of it. It's one of the reasons why President Eisenhower, when the Soviets sent tanks into Hungary in 1956 and Czechoslovakia, I think it was 1968, the subsequent, not just him, but specifically in 1956 into Hungary, we didn't go in to help them then, like we have done now with Ukraine when you had this war kick off, because he said, I am not going to risk nuclear war with the Soviet Union over this one country here, because he realized that the potential for escalation, and he wasn't about to risk your security and my security, well, those who were alive at the time, of course, because he realized that the catastrophic threat of a nuclear weapon and how devastating it would be. We've lost that. Those generations are gone. Now then, we don't think anything of it. We just think it's another saber to rattle. And that they'll never do that because they know we have all these nuclear weapons and we would retaliate. And so that certainty will keep them from doing anything. But now then, there are those in Russia that are thinking differently. They're saying, you know what? You're not the only one that can go down that path. And if you think we would never do it, then you may be shocked. Because we may, because what they're seeing is that their country has been attacked by technology and physical support and apparently airspace support here recently from the West against their country. And let me just ask you, first of all, this question. Be honest with yourself. If your country, and whether you're watching this in Great Britain or France or here in the United States, if China or Russia through another country, Cuba, Canada, Mexico, something like that. One of the countries that are near us. If things deteriorate, we end up fighting this country here. And then they, through that country, strike targets that are now hitting American factories, American oil refineries, American storage depots, electricity grids, et cetera. And we know it came from them. The technology could only have come from them. Mexico or Cuba, they don't have that capability. It could only have come from them, and we know it did. Are we going to go, well, I mean, we can't do anything about it. I mean, we aren't directly at war with China or Russia, so we just can't do anything. We'll hit Mexico harder or something. You know that that's not the case. We would be screaming bloody murder, and we would be demanding that those countries suffer. Well, that's what is going on in Russia. They have been angry at their government for not doing that and allowing us carte blanche to do anything that we want to in Russia. And they're saying that those days need to come to an end. Now, this is even more problematic because of the balance of power between the two. I keep talking about spreadsheets sometimes, and especially between the U.S. and Iran, and how that's, you know, we're way up here and they're way down there, but still because of geography and some other stuff. Well, let's take a look at that spreadsheet because it's changed from what it was before 2022 and before 2023 and before 2025 and 6. Because now then, all of the West, we've bragged so many times, so going back to the Biden administration, about all these 50 countries, primarily from Western Europe, and how we've given tens of thousands of combat vehicles, millions of rounds, hundreds of millions of rounds of various kinds of ammunition, tens of thousands, and maybe even more than that, of missiles, interceptor missiles, offensive missiles, long-range cruise missiles, all kinds of things. And we have given so much of that to Ukraine, and it's just been burned up. And our industrial capacity, because we're not at war, we don't have a wartime economy, we've marginally escalated them and expanded them. Marginally, not a lot, but a little bit. And so our outgoing missile inventories is huge because it is a wartime situation, but we're not replacing it. So our inventories keep draining. Then now that in 10-7-2023, then you've added all the U.S. especially has been sending a bunch of these same categories of missiles to Israel. And then in 2025, and I think 2024, you can start with there. We started doing stuff against the Houthis, use more missiles. And then in 2025, with Operation Midnight Hammer, we lost a bunch more there too. We gave a lot more to Israel to use against Iran, both interceptors and offensive missiles. They were so done. And then, of course, now this war. Now we've had this massive drain just in the first 40 days of this one, and we're thinking about starting another one. On the other side of the ledger is the Russian side. They have been on a military full footing economically. They did go to something close to a full military mobilization of their economy. And so their defense industrial base has cranked up several times more than what it was. By some estimates I've read and some report experts I've talked to, they actually could do more. They didn't go to a full mobilization. That's why they call it a special military operation as opposed to a war, because that implies another level of industrial transformation. But what they have done, even with that, is substantial. It's like multiple times more than what it was. But now then, they have been spending the last 18 or so months stockpiling all the categories of weapons that we have been draining. Understand that. That's why this is so dangerous. It's unthinkable because it breaks every paradigm that we've known since we were born. But when you look at the balance of power, we have been draining our stockpiles, and Russia has been building their stockpiles of the missiles that we have shown in both, really going back to the 2020 Armenia-Azerbaijan war, the Russia-Ukraine war, the Israel and its wars against Hamas, Hezbollah in Yemen and Syria and wherever else they've been fighting, and then ours now against Iran. All the key drone capabilities and the key missile offensive and defenses that matter the most, we have drained our resources. We're trying to build up some of the drones, but it's incremental compared to what the Russian side is, which is off the charts. That's what we need to understand. The calculations are now different than they were because of our foolish actions and all these other pointless wars that never needed to have been fought. Now then, Russia is in a position to where theoretically, and again, let me just, I don't have any insight into what's actually going on inside of the Kremlin. None whatsoever. I can just read the tea leaves like you can or see statements that are made in public. But what I can do is count. And what I do see is, while our defensive capacity and offensive capacity are both drained from what it was before, and our industrial capacity is still on a peacetime level, and it would take years to get to a wartime production capability, and the Russians are already there, and with these big stockpiles in every offensive and defensive category that matters, they have huge stockpiles by most accounting. So if they, from that position, if they can do math, they may say, we can launch conventional missiles here, and there's nothing you can do to stop virtually any of them, whether it's hypersonics or the Yureshnik. We'll hit everything that we want, and you basically have no air defense that you can stop it. And if you say, how dare you do that, Article 5, and we're now going to go to war with you, and it's the 32 nations of NATO against the one of Russia, just understand, I don't care how many countries are numbered. That's not what matters. The only thing that matters is your production capacity and how much you can do and how much you can produce and how much you have ready to defend and how much you have ready to make on offense. And it's like this. And the Russian side is like this. That's the reality. You can see where Russia, unlike anything that has existed in our lifetime, could be in a position now to take a risk, thinking that, yeah, if you don't listen to us and stop your support for the Ukraine war and bring it to an end right now, then we can escalate here and we can outdo you. Now, of course, if it goes nuclear, if it's the mutually assured destruction, then none of the conventional stuff matters. And it doesn't matter if we had none and they had all. If both sides have nuclear weapons and you get into theater or nuclear weapons, it's game over for everybody. So everybody loses. But what we don't know is we have comforted ourselves by saying because of that, Russia would never take step one because they know that step five is mutually assured destruction and they're not suicidal. They're not going to do that. But what if they calculate differently? What if they calculate, I think you can do math. And I think that because you recognize that step five is mutually assured destruction, so you're not going to take step two. That would be a radical thing to do, which I hope they don't do, because I fear foolish and weak men who are scared to death but have a nuclear button nearby that they can push, that they may resort to that irrationally, that they may not do that calculation. I hope Russia doesn't put us into that situation. But unfortunately, our foolish actions up to this point have made this a plausible scenario, because they may say, I'm tired of you hitting and you're accelerating. It's not even continuing on. It's accelerating because Ukraine has had more success striking further and deeper and more accurately into the Russian interland. And, you know, now they're using the airspace, allegedly, of NATO countries on top of the technology and the intelligence and the targeting support, which everybody knows that we're providing. So now then, because we keep doing that and thinking that, well, because of that, Russia, because of the mutual assured destruction, Russia would never do anything. So we're free to do everything. They didn't respond to any of these others. You see what I'm saying here? We have deluded ourselves into thinking that we have all the escalation cards and that therefore Russia will never do anything. And we're free to play in their background and blow stuff up and ha ha, look at them. But what if the Russian side says, we're not playing that game anymore. And now then it's your turn to start sweating. It's possible. I can't stress enough. I don't have any insider information. I don't know this is going to happen, but I am enough alarmed by the categories of weapons and the dearth of weapons stockpiles on our side and the huge amounts on the other side that this is something we need to pay a lot of attention to. We need to, just like we need to walk away from this war in Iran, we need to end the one in Russia and Ukraine so we get this the possibilities off the table. Because if Russia does take that decision, we would face a potential nuclear strike from somebody. And then God help us if weak and foolish men or arrogant men, if on the Russian side even, are the ones calling the shots here for all of us. We have to hope it doesn't get to that. Bit of a heavy show today, folks, but we need to make sure we're unintimidated and uncompromised to bring you the truth. And this is the evidence that's out there. And this is what some people are saying, and that here's some of the fundamentals. You need to know about them. I don't want anybody to be shocked and taken by surprise by this. And if you know of anybody in your country, wherever you're watching this from, talk to your politicians, talk to your leaders, and say, it's time for us to stop being stupid and get these wars off the table so we can get back into just some kind of normal living where we don't have to worry about nuclear escalation. Thank you a lot, folks. We appreciate you. I will be traveling for the next 7 or so days. So we won't have as many shows. Gary probably will be doing some on his own. But if anything happens, I'll find a way to get onto a camera. I'm going to be on some. I'm not going to take the week off, but it might not be as many as you've gotten used to. But just wanted to let you know there, and we'll look forward to seeing you anytime there's breaking information on the Daniel Davis Deep Dive. Don't forget to tell your friends, the ones that love to listen to podcasts. Get them to add Daniel Davis Deep Dive to their podcast list. They need to know what you know. They can get it to where they already get their podcast. You just got to tell them.